Hello, I'm Robert J. Sawyer. This is number 0561, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0561. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, actor Scott Turner Schofield. He's one of the stars of the digital soap opera called Studio City. His character is a transgender actor in the show within a show.
I know that one of the storylines is Max's struggle to be visibly transgender for the reasons that it is important to be that, right? Right now, I think both in the world of the show, which reflects the world that we all live in, you know, there is still this importance about, you know, being openly trans, being visible, because not enough people have a face to put with that label and have a way to look at that and go, actually, this is something positive. These are, you know, people like all the rest of us.
Stuart Nullman is in with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman, and Book Banter welcomes back Temperance Brennan as she's back on the case with Kathy Reich's new book, A Conspiracy of Bones. Get ready to do some digging up a cold case later on the Stuff File program.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later. The person who told you this was show number 0561 was best-selling science fiction author Robert J. Sawyer, whose new novel, his 26th, is called The Oppenheimer Alternative, which takes us back to the creation of the atomic bomb, but with a twist. By the way, Robert will be here on next week's show to tell you all about his new book and also about how he's doing these days in isolation. Thank you very much, Robert, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make the show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? In Kokkoland Free State Province, South Africa, where the now seven-week-long lockdown includes a ban on buying or selling alcoholic beverages, thieves broke into the Rest in Peace funeral parlor and made off with 4 gallons of exhumation liquid. The fluid is used to preserve body parts that have been exhumed and is 97% alcohol. And the burglars had to break through roller blinds and into a locked steel cabinet to get to the liquid. A forensic officer predicted if the thieves drink that liquid without watering it right down, then they'll drop dead themselves. Yeah, well, it's not like they were counseled into ingesting bleach or anything. Citizens of Beverly Hills, California have prevailed on the city council to classify a specific type of business as essential, making them allowed to reopen during the pandemic. It's bad policy and it's irresponsible, complains John Mirisch, the only councilman to vote against the rule change. Not only does it send the wrong message, it's just the wrong thing to do at this time. Still, the change went forward with the vote. Cosmetic surgeries may immediately resume, such as facelifts, breast augmentation, and liposuction. Wow. Meanwhile, the world is telling people not to touch their face. You know, here's a tip for Hollywood types. Yes, you'll have a good-looking corpse, but they don't allow open caskets in COVID cases. Just letting you know. Okay. We all should have seen this one coming. With everybody not just encouraged, but in many places required to wear a mask when walking into any public business, it should be no surprise that some entrepreneurial individuals would take advantage of that situation. But in some areas, the spike in armed robberies has been dramatic, even for America. Police in Santa Ana, California, have reported that robberies in the city have increased by 50% since the lockdown. Just last week, a masked man walked into a gas station at 2 a.m. and pointed a gun right at the clerk, while his accomplice, also wearing a mask, grabbed the cash. The owner said he had never seen anything like it in his 17 years that he's run his Santa Ana gas station and convenience store. He said local face covering requirements put his staff in danger. In a similar robbery last month, a thief hid his face with a bandana at a donut shop in Bristol. The cashier was caught off guard when the thief pulled out a gun and placed it on the counter. The thief then emptied both registers before getting away. Police said they were not exactly sure why there has been such an increase in robberies, but said it could be related to the number of inmates released from area jails during the pandemic. You know, it's interesting that the number of armed robberies are going up at a time when there are so few establishments open in the first place, and the ones that aren't exactly lighting up the world with revenue. Okay, here's a story that will make you really want to scratch your head in wonder. The Chinese Academy of Social Sciences Tourism Research Center joined two other tourism research councils to study where Chinese citizens might want to travel once restrictions ease. Based on more than 15,000 questionnaires, in-depth one-on-one interviews, and analysis of more than 20 million online posts, the number one choice by far is Wuhan. Yes, Wuhan, where the coronavirus first jumped from animals to humans to spark this pandemic. As far as international destinations, the United States was number one before the outbreak. Now it's not even in the top 10. You know the old saying of there's no such thing as bad publicity? Well, Wuhan can literally be ground zero of that phrase, too. Gee, I'm beginning to wonder, what's the second favorite destination of the Chinese? Chernobyl? Ooh. That could be some deadly traveling. Which is a good time to bring this up. The bell tolls for one reason. It's time for the Darwin File.
I am the Grim Reaper. I am death.
57-year-old fingernail technician Cynthia Renee Covert made a house call to do nails for Barbara Howell at her Kiowa Island, South Carolina home. As Covert worked on Howell's nails on the outdoor porch, she was fascinated by a large alligator in a nearby pond, so after the session, she went to get a closer look. Howell warned her that the gator had recently grabbed a deer on the shore. "I don't look like a deer," Covert replied, and reached down to pet the beast. Howell and her husband, William, started screaming at her to get away as William ran to pull her back. Before he arrived, the animal grabbed her by the leg and dragged her into the water. When Covert got waist deep, William says, she stated in a very calm voice, "I guess I won't do that again." And with that, the gator rolled over, pulling her underwater. The pond was still by the time Charleston County Sheriff deputies arrived. A short time later, the gator surfaced, and a deputy shot it in the head several times with his sidearm, causing it to release Covert's body. The coroner listed the cause of her death as accidental drowning. You have to admit, Covert was right. She won't do that again. This was just a covert operation gone bad. Now that the alligator is dead, perhaps Covert's family can get a nice pair of shoes and a matching handbag to remember her by. In any case, Cynthia Renee Covert has learned, as have so many before her, that the tree of life is often self-pruning.
I have come for you. I am death.
A bull attempting to alleviate an itchy behind by using a utility pole ended up knocking out the electricity for more than 700 homes in a Scottish town. Hazel Lofton posted an apology to a local Facebook group after her 4-year-old bull, Ron, rubbed up against the utility pole and ended up knocking the transformer box to the ground. She wrote on that post, "Our bull, Ron, would like to apologize to everyone in Chapleton and Strathaven for causing last night's power cut to over 700 homes. He had an itchy bum, so he scratched it on the electricity pole and knocked the transformer box off." She said Ron is happy to be alive after managing to avoid an 11,000-volt shock from the fallen transformer box. Lofton, who has a farm with her husband, said the local utility company restored power a few hours later. Well, good thing that Ron avoided an 11,000-volt shock. That would have been a lot of seared brisket. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, the Canadian Imperial Bank of Commerce, the CIBC, said an administrative error was made when one of their customer service phone numbers was retired from use, but still appeared on the bank's website, sending customers to an adult party chat line. Dialing the 800-663-4653 number listed on the CIBC website leads to a woman's pre-recorded voice on the line.
"Welcome to America's Hottest Talk Line. Guys, hot ladies are waiting to talk to you. Press 1 now. Ladies, to talk to interesting and exciting guys free, press 2 to connect free now."
According to CIBC spokeswoman Trish Turvert, the telephone number was retired from use previously, and upon learning of this, we immediately updated the website. There was no word on how long the phone number was on the bank's website directing to the adult chat line, or how many CIBC customers might have called it and received the surprise. You know, what I'd like to know is how many people call the number more than once. Also, after connecting, how many people went a little further?
"Guys, press 1 now. Ladies, press 2 now."
Did this service lead to big interest? Was there a penalty for early withdrawal? Do you want to go into the vault for safe sex? Is your fiscal irresponsibility leading to inflationary pressure? Hey, babe, you are finer than the print on my credit card agreement. Let's get out of here and appreciate each other's assets. Oh yeah, I got a lot of bank puns for you. I'm generous to a vault.
"Guys, press 1 now. Ladies, press 2 now."
Anyway, let's get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Over the last few weeks, we've had a few of the stars of the digital drama Studio City on the program. Well, we have one more on the show. Scott Turner Schofield is an actor, writer, producer, and speaker. You may remember Scott's stint on The Bold and the Beautiful. On Studio City, Scott plays the role of Max and Dr. Brantley in the show within a show. Scott joins us via Skype from California. Hi, Scott.
Hi. Hi, everyone. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on the program with us. Now, looking over your resume, looking over all the things you do, going to your website, we should mention that you're a major advocate in the transgender community. I specifically didn't say transgender actor when I introduced you. I'm just wondering, do you prefer that, or do you wish there was a time when you could just be an actor?
I mean, all I've ever wanted was to just be an actor. And I knew I'd have to help change the world a little bit in order to get there. So that's where all of the transgender advocacy comes in. It's been kind of rough during this season of Emmy voting. You know, you have to do a lot of self-promotion, which is always awkward and difficult. But how many times people have said, oh, it's, you know, we're voting now for people based on their gender identity, are they? And it's sort of like, okay, well, I guess I'll take away that acting degree and those multiple awards for acting that I've gotten over the years, since that can't be why I'm up for awards. You know, it's such a rough situation that we're in.
Well, tell me about the role that you play. As I mentioned, two roles. It's a show within a show. So Max is the actor and Dr. Brantley is the character. Is that correct?
Yes. So, I mean, I suppose they're both characters.
Yes. So tell me about the characters you play in Studio City.
Sure. So Max is a character who is an actor who plays Dr. Brantley on Hearts on Fire, which is the second biggest daytime drama in this little world of Studio City. And there are some things that are similar for our stories and some things that aren't. It's from what I know, we had this one season and we're waiting to see what we get to do in the second season. But I know that one of the storylines is Max's struggle to be visibly transgender for the reasons that it is important to be that, right? Right now, I think both in the world of the show, which reflects the world that we all live in, there is still this importance about, being openly trans, being visible, because not enough people have a face to put with that label and have a way to look at that and go, actually, this is something positive. These are people like all the rest of us. And so I think there's definitely a struggle there, which wasn't the same for me. It's always been very much front and center to sort of say, I'm going to put this out there because, there's a need for it. There's a need for people to see and be seen.
Now, when you were on The Bold and the Beautiful, again, that was also a situation where you were playing a character who was identified as transgendered, and it was one of the first, if I'm not mistaken, in daytime.
Yeah, in fact, the first openly transgender actor in daytime television. Openly is important because trans people have always been around, but they just didn't talk about it because the discrimination was so intense.
So in doing a daytime drama, there's a lot of dialogue to go through. There's a lot of pressure in getting that character right when you're doing pages and pages of dialogue. That's enough pressure for any actor. What was it like for you being the first blazing a trail, as it were? Did you feel any added pressure?
I mean, there was just, it was my first TV break. So that was the pressure that I felt. I had, 15 years in professional theater before that. And in some ways, working on daytime is a lot like working in theater. There's just the way that it's sort of set up. It felt very much like theater to me. But except for that, we blazed through 40 pages of text every day, right? That was new for sure. There was mostly just the pressure of being on television for the first time. The rest of it, I've kind of often been a first. The trans movement is kind of it's not new by any stretch, but it's kind of new to the world. The world is just discovering us. So I'm used to kind of being a first. But yeah, that moment of walking onto set for the first time and hearing, action for the first time, that was a big deal for me.
With all your theater background, with all your theater and acting training, it's one thing to do the role, but as you said earlier, and as I mentioned in the introduction, you are also an activist. You have a website, Speaking of Transgender. What made you do that leap? In other words, not just staying in your lane and working in your craft, but wanting to get the word out and being an activist. What led you to that?
Well, like I said, so I really only ever wanted to be an actor. My degree from college is in theater. I got straight A's in my theater degree, highest honors, graduated, right? And what they recognized even then was I wasn't getting picked for roles, right? I was somebody who was getting straight A's in my acting labs and not getting picked for roles. And so they allowed me to write my own one-person show and perform that, because that was going to be the only way that I was going to have a leading role, which I needed to have the experience of in order to have a proper experience of acting school and an equal experience to my peers, right? So I wrote this one-man show, and it was about my experience of figuring out that I was trans and what that meant to me. And I ended up actually touring it around the country before I even graduated from college. It just got picked up and people wanted to see it. There was interest. I toured that show for 9 years around the US and Europe. And I realized in that journey that if I gave a talk about what being transgender was, just what it was at all, 100 people would come to see the show. And if I didn't, maybe only 20 people would come to see the show. So I quickly realized that if I became sort of a person who speaks about these topics, I could, change the world the way that I knew it needed to be changed, right, in very small increments. chiseling away at it very humbly. But also I could, you know, that would support me doing the acting work I wanted to do.
Because of your visibility as an activist, do you feel that sometimes it pigeonholes you as an actor? And the reason why I say that is it not possible for you to apply for and audition for characters that their sexuality or their gender fluidity is not an issue?
Not quite yet in Hollywood. This is the thing that we're really coming up against right now. So when I walk into an audition room, I'm being judged as to whether or not I pull off being a man, first of all, right? I'm a transgender man, right? So born female, but, you know, when anybody meets me, I would have to tell you that I was trans in order for you to know that, right? But because of when I started doing this work, it wasn't quite so clear. It wasn't, you know, I was very much in transition, very much sort of non-binary in that way. I had to be open about it because we had to talk about it. It was the elephant in the room. So when you Google me now, you know I'm trans. And so then that scrutiny comes, like, is this guy even what you even think a guy looks like? And that's an extra layer of scrutiny that comes between me and someone's ability to see me just doing my craft as an actor, right? And so that's what we're really kind of working toward. If people are open about this and we can, you know, help casting directors and producers and directors and everybody involved in this really see the talent that we bring to this just on its own, right? Like you do for every other actor, then certainly a role that isn't specifically gendered, right? Like, you know, a teacher or a barista or, you know, someone who's, you know, what's between their legs doesn't actually matter to what they're doing, you know, like that could actually change who gets seen for those roles and who gets picked for those roles, because there won't be so much of a barrier left.
See, I bring up the point because in my career, I've done a fair amount of voice acting. And therefore, I see a similar situation in your case that I would see in my case, because I have gone up for roles and done character voices for certain roles as a voice actor, where the fact that I'm Black was not an issue. Right. I've also done accents.
You didn't see the character, right?
Exactly. Right? It was just a character. So it's not a visual thing. And conversely, I have lost roles because somebody has seen my picture and when they heard me, figured I wasn't Black enough for a particular role. I've seen both sides of that situation. And that's why I brought up the question, because, you know, if the character is or isn't transgender, why couldn't you go up for a role that wasn't a transgender role, is what I'm saying.
Truly. And that's our question too. You know, I would say that there's a lot of differences between our experiences. I'm white and, you know, I move through the world as a white man now, which is a real difference from what it was when I was a girl, mm-hmm. right? From how I grew up. I see those differences very clearly, but I do think that there are a lot of parallels. And when I look back at like the history of film and television, I think about Sidney Poitier and what, you know, all of the activism he had to do to just be one of the best actors, period, on the face of the earth. I mean, can we just talk about Sidney Poitier for a second, right?
Right.
Right? Like, you know, all of the work that he had to do, I admire that so much, and it really has given me so much courage to just keep doing this, because I know in the end it's going to be fine, right? It's just going to take a little while.
Well, you mentioned courage. It's given you courage. How have you evolved because of your advocacy? How have you evolved as an actor? In other words, what has being an advocate given you as far as strength is concerned to fulfill your dreams of being an actor?
I love that question. Well, you know, acting is hearing no 100 times a year, right? And you keep doing acting because you know you believe in yourself, you know that you're good enough, and you know that at some point someone's going to recognize that and they're going to say yes and they're going to open the door. And, you know, I think both my career as an actor and my career as an activist, or my calling as an activist, I should say, you know, really feed each other in that way. I've seen just in the last 5 years, 2016 was a real turning point for the community, because suddenly I could take all the people that I'd worked with from, you know, starting in 2002, all of the talks that I'd given, all of the audiences that have come to listen to me speak as an activist, and I could put them all together, and they still wouldn't amount to the number of people now who care, who are saying yes, who want to get this right, who want to just be respectful and don't want to, like, accidentally really harm somebody with their thinking or the way that they, you know, speak in the world, right? And, you know, since 2016, it's just changed so much. So as an activist, I've seen the world change, and it's continuing to change. And as an actor, that really helps me, because I know that my time is coming, right? This is the second time I've been in the Blue Ribbon round for a Daytime Emmy, and whatever happens, that's amazing. You know, I know that people are starting to see me. They're starting to see my talent, not my gender. And at some point, that's going to be able to speak for itself.
And we should mention you're in the running for your characters on Studio City. I'm assuming the first time was when you were on The Bold and the Beautiful?
That's right.
Well, again, kudos to those. We are talking with Scott Turner Schofield here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Scott is an actor, writer, producer, and speaker. He's one of the stars of the digital program Studio City, where he plays the role of Max and also Dr. Brantley in a show within a show. We'll continue talking with Scott. We'll take a quick break here on the Stuff File program. Don't go away.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to The Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder, coming to you from Montreal, Canada, where we share the longest unprotected border in the world with the United States. Take that as a sign of extreme friendship. Or a warning.
Yes, this is indeed the Stuff File program, which is heard everywhere, including on Stitcher and TuneIn, and can also be heard via Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Just click on the Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, or Spotify buttons located on the website at thestufffile.com, and whichever platform you listen to the program on, please feel free to leave a review of the show on their site. It would be greatly appreciated. We're continuing our chat with Scott Turner Schofield. He's an actor that you can see in the show Studio City, which is a show within a show. He plays two roles. He plays Max and Dr. Brantley, as I said, in a show within a show. Scott is also a writer, a producer, a speaker, an activist. He does a lot of things. And Scott, how long have you wanted to be an actor? Was this something that was always within you?
Certainly. I mean, I was that kid. I would block the television. My parents would just be trying to have a nice evening, you know, and I would be acting out all the roles for them. I've always, you know, in some ways, it's exactly the same to my being trans, right? I've always known who I was. And on one side, that's I've always known that I was supposed to be male at birth, and for whatever reason that didn't happen. And I've also always known that I'm a performer and I need to be out in front of people. It's just a blessing and a curse, right?
When did you start professionally seeking your calling as an actor?
So I chose to go to Emory University in Atlanta. And the reason why I chose that was because their theater program was actually a professional theater company. So when you elected to put your primary focus on that major, you became a member of their professional company. And, you know, I learned in a very sort of conservatory style kind of way in that way. So I guess I would say, gosh, almost 20 years ago at this point.
The reason why I asked the question is I'm sure you started acting and wanted to be an actor when you were still a girl. Would that be an accurate statement?
Yes, actually. You know, when I acted in high school, when you say professional, you know, I think about the professional world. I was acting in school, of course, like in a sort of amateur way. And yes, I was acting as a girl. But it was always funny when I think about it now. The characters that I played were always not your typical girls. Right?
Because the reason I ask is I'm just curious to know, especially considering you've gone through the training professionally through school, how has your transgender changed your acting from what it was before, if at all?
Yeah, so, gosh, that's a really insightful question. My being trans has meant that I have spent my entire life acting, right? I mean, from the earliest age, I was very clear that I was a boy. You know, I was 3-4 years old saying, look, everybody, this isn't right, you know. But unfortunately, back then, really nobody had any language to be able to understand or support that. And so my whole life took on a performative quality to it at very deep levels, right, in my family and my friend group, which for a child is extremely important. It's about your survival. So I learned, you know, and I was on the homecoming court in high school. I went to debutante balls, right? Like, I was very much in that world, and it was all an act. So, you know, learning to act has been a lifelong project for me because I'm trans, actually. And it's given me a way to sink into a character that's entirely physical. That's, you know, I get into the entire body of my character. And, you know, as we were learning things in school about, you know, embodying your character, I was like, this comes very naturally to me. And it would take a while for me to put that together, that actually it was the gift of being transgender, that, you know, I could learn how to act from the very beginning.
So you've been playing a role, as you said, all of your life. When you finally transitioned, there's a certain amount of freedom with that. Did it also free your acting abilities?
It did, because there's, finally I was just acting. Right, I was taking all of these things that I had learned how to do over my whole life and putting it into my art form, which is really where my passion is. And when you get to do your passion, right, when you have that privilege and that blessing to get to do your passion in that way, it is, you just get into a flow that's so enlivening, right? When you really know that you are where you're supposed to be and you're doing what you're supposed to be doing, that's something that most people wish for in their lives. And I think having that awareness that, oh, look, now I finally get to do that, right? That really did set me free, as you say.
So now we're in a time where everything is locked down. Hopefully things will get to somewhat normal or a new normal. I guess you're looking forward to the possibility that there'll be a second season of Studio City?
I am. I love what they did in the first season. I would love to see this show get to, you know, be all that it could possibly be. And I'd love to be a part of it.
and besides that, is there anything else that you are tentatively working on or anything else that we can possibly see in the not too distant future?
Yes, I have been. So my third one-man show was called Becoming a Man in 127 Easy Steps. And it was based on the neo-futurist theater idea where you pick a story by number. So there was 127 stories and the audience would call out a number between 1 and 127. And you might hear 6 to 8 different stories in a night. It was a different show every time. So it was like a really fun acting challenge for me. And, you know, it was there to sort of give you a picture of a transgender life that isn't stuck in transition. One of the things I really love about the character Max, for instance, is his transition happened already. He's just a guy who's an actor now, and he has this rich history of being trans, but it's not a secret, it's not a surprise, and he's not in that sort of teenage moment of being in transition, right? So many of our stories are about people in transition, which if you did it on a human scale, it would be like just telling teenagehood over and over and over again, which is kind of stuck and boring. So I took this sort of idea of the whole life and how can you do that? And about 5 years ago, I was approached by a film producer out here in LA who really wanted to figure out how to make it into a film project. And we are on the road to completing it. We've completed a feature film that went to Tribeca this year. And I was very pleased. It got really great response. We're having some really good meetings. And so I'm very much looking forward to that coming out sometime in the next year or so, so that everybody can see it and really sort of start to get an understanding, a deeper understanding than television and film currently gives us about what being a transgender man specifically is about.
And what for you is the holy grail? What if, when you're lying in bed and you're daydreaming about the perfect role for you and what you'd like to do, what is that?
Oh, wow. It changes so often, but, the Holy Grail, I think for me, is to be an actor in the ilk of Tilda Swinton or Johnny Depp, right? These actors who can just embody anything and who get to tell stories that just take the viewer on a ride. If my way of taking viewers on a ride is in a way that helps people understand gender and understand their own gender better, that will be a life well lived. If I can do that in a way that allows me to be completely free of all of these labels and thereby takes everybody along with me, right? Then, yeah, I'd call that the Holy Grail, I think.
You mentioned theater, taking theater school, and what about Broadway?
Oh, it would be wonderful. My wife she writes musicals, and so she's been involved with a musical that was going to go to Broadway. We're not sure what's happening now with it, but that was our sort of first, my first big brush with that. And, as that keeps going, I am totally open to that possibility.
Well, wait a minute. Your wife writes musicals?
She does. She's a singer-songwriter, and she's been writing. She's written she's transliterated. So she took a musical that was written in Spanish, and they gave her the English translation, but what she had to do was put every single accent and syllable in English exactly the way that it was in Spanish. So it's like just a bonkers math problem for her. And she's in the midst of her debut musical right now.
So is there any begging on your part for her to write a part for you, or is that something she's just naturally doing?
Yeah, I don't have to beg for that.
Well, that's great. Congratulations on all that you've done so far. Congratulations on being on the Blue Ribbon panel for a potential Emmy for Studio City. I thank you very much, Scott, for taking the time to be on the program with us. I mentioned your website, speakingoftransgender.com. Very briefly, tell us what people will find when they go there.
So speakingoftransgender.com is my advocacy website. You'll find all of the different things that I do in terms of, helping people understand transgender identity and what our issues are, and just sort of helping the world transition into a kinder and smarter place around those topics. And my actor website, where you can find all of whatever else I'm doing creatively, is my name, scotttschofield.com.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Scott, for being on the program with us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. Thanks for the thoughtful questions.
Actor Scott Turner Schofield. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com. Check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0561. And you'll find links to Scott's websites, both of them. And you'll also find a link to the digital series he's on, which, of course, is Studio City, which is available in the U.S. on Amazon Prime Video. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
Latitude 47 degrees 14 minutes north. Longitude 84 degrees 39 minutes west. Location Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
Yes, let's go down to the lab and see what's on the slab. It's another edition of Book Banter. Here is Stuart Nauman. Hello, Stu.
Hi, Peter. Don't mind the dirt that's trailing me. I was just digging up some evidence, actually. Excuse the dirt and the gravel and all that stuff.
Absolutely.
Ugh. Let me tell you, it's dirty work. And speaking of dirty work, this edition of Book Banter, we're going to go back and Kathy writes. She is back, along with her character Temperance Brennan, who is a forensic anthropologist for the state of North Carolina, also in Quebec. And they return after a brief absence with a vengeance with her new book, A Conspiracy of Bones.
We had Kathy on the program a little over a month ago, a delightful lady indeed.
Oh yeah, no, I saw her spoke last fall at Concordia. Always some great stories about her profession in forensic anthropology and also as a best-selling author. Never a dull moment with Kathy.
Yeah.
But this new mystery takes place during a stifling hot summer in North Carolina, in which a faceless, ravaged corpse, thanks to some feral pigs, turns up on the banks of a North Carolina river with some clues that helps identify the corpse, but not the mystery surrounding the victim, whose name is actually Felix Vodyanov. Now, enlisting the aid of a gruff homicide investigator in North Carolina, his name is Skinny Slidell. I love that name. Skinny Slidell has a kind of Hollywood flair to it. Temperance goes deep into the North Carolina backwoods to find out more about Vodyanov, and why he met such a gruesome end. And she finds out that he was connected to a spy ring, as well as a group of survivalist conspiracy theorists, and also linked to a string of child abductions. Now, if that's not enough for Temperance, she has to deal with personal medical issues like the migraines that were brought about by an aneurysm that she survived, and a vain glory hound of a supervisor at the medical examiner's office who's bent on undermining everything that Temperance does to this case. No matter what she discovers, no matter what turns up, her name is Dr. Heavener. I mean, if that doesn't tell you anything, always tries to downgrade it and take the glory from Temperance. Now, the book reads to me like a jigsaw puzzle as you follow Temperance, who tries to find all the pieces of the puzzle, that is the murder of Felix Vodyanov, yet there are missing pieces that just remain elusive. And you know what? I found the book compulsively readable. It's quite a very good mystery to read, as you find out that what could have been a case of a corpse with no name or face has so many widespread ripples to it.
Hmm. By the way, did you say
it's like a cold case gone hot?
What was the name of the police person she was dealing with?
The person at the medical examiner's office?
Yeah.
Dr. Heavener.
No, you mentioned a detective?
Oh yeah, Skinny Slidell.
Skinny Slidell. Wow.
Yeah.
Doesn't that sound like a 1950s wrestler?
Maybe he was, and then he thought the life in the ring wasn't the greatest, and he decided to
take up
the badge.
But by the way, that name Skinny, is it accurate or ironic?
No, this is accurate.
Oh, okay.
But he's like a cussing, chain-smoking, beer-guzzling, old-school kind of detective.
Okay. Okay.
But he could have had a career in the ring. It's very possible.
This is the 19th Temperance Brennan book that Kathy has put out. So very prolific.
Oh yeah, she's been churning them out since 1996. And top the bestseller lists from day one.
Yep.
That's not easy to do, let me tell you.
No, it is not.
You know, I remember when I was introduced to Kathy Reichs. Her books, actually. It was at a CBA convention, booksellers convention.
Right.
And they gave me this, they said the publisher gave me this book, said, you gotta read it, and it was in an evidence envelope.
Oh, wow. Nice.
Yeah.
Nice promotion.
It certainly was. That got me hooked.
Now, have you read a lot of Kathy's books?
Yes, I have. Not all of them, but most of them. More of her earlier works. And I know you always mention what books I like to recommend on this vein. And I do want to recommend her first book, Deja Dead. That's the one I got in the evidence envelope.
Okay.
And I think that sort of got me hooked on her books. And I tried to read also Patricia Cornwell's books, and I couldn't get into Cornwell. I couldn't get into those books. But somehow Kathy sort of brings a little bit of grit and flair to and sense of realism. And also... she's pretty well explicit when it comes to mentioning the bodies that she has to work with. Pretty gruesome at times, but that's the life when you're in forensic anthropology.
So what you're saying, basically, is with complete irony, she brings the autopsy to life?
Oh, yeah. But you know what? This book, Conspiracy of Bone, is not as gruesome as some of her other works. It sticks more to the mystery of this one corpse than the other corpses that she dealt with, like if some two or three corpses in other books. But it's not as gory, put it this way.
So as you mentioned, you've read several of her books. Where would you rank this latest one in the canon of the books you've read so far?
I think it's pretty well up there. I mean, not in the same level as Deja Dead. But I think, sort of like I say around the top five, actually.
Okay. So again, the book is...
A Conspiracy of Bones by Kathy Reichs. It's published by Scribner, and it's $36.99.
And which drawer will we find Stuart Nelman in if we're looking for him?
Well, not the dead letter office, that's for sure. No, you're going to find me in the files of the Montreal Times, in print or online at www.mtltimes.ca.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Stuart.
Oh, you're welcome, Peter. Let me continue my digging right now, so I will speak to you later.
Okay. Stuart Nelman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about a racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program. We do have a few more Stuff File news stories to share with you, and also an idiot of the day here on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio, and also on Spotify. Well, under the headline of people we are definitely not paying enough, a report released last week said slowing down a second wave of COVID-19 could be assisted by studying human feces in sewer systems, said Nasha Gailey, co-founder of BioBot, a wastewater epidemiology firm. Infected patients are excreting the novel coronavirus SARS-CoV-2 in stool. That's how we end up being able to see the coronavirus along with a whole bunch of other human health information in our city sewer system. Without widespread testing available, which is likely to be the case in many countries, studying sewage samples could be an asset to figure out if COVID-19 returns with a vengeance. Gailey went on to say, "We need a way to very easily and rapidly get a snapshot of what's happening. It's very important that we have a robust surveillance infrastructure in place to be able to detect any new outbreaks and immediately contain them." BioBot, an American company, has collected 300 sewage samples in 40 U.S. states and uses the samples to determine how much of the virus is present and how significant it is in certain areas. However, some scientists indicate that this all might be just, well, a bunch of crap, said Natalie Prisjacki from the BC Center for Disease Control. I would caution people from using it as an absolute truth and recognizing that often with models, there can be a high degree of uncertainty. She started testing wastewater in British Columbia last week. She went on to say, I would just want people to make sure that they understood the limitations of the data as they interpret it. Again, no matter which side of the debate you come down on, we aren't paying these people enough. I mean, rummaging through the sewers. Ew. If only I knew a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle.
Who the heck is that? Wayne Gretzky? On steroids?
Oh, I do. God love Robbie Wrist, the voice of Michelangelo. By the way, Robbie is also the host of a great podcast called The Spoon, along with Tom Bowers and Chris Jackson. It's a weekly hoot and a must listen. You have got to check it out. That's The Spoon. Anyway, 50-year-old cancer patient Gladys Rodriguez Duarte was rushed to a clinic in Paraguay on April 11th after her blood pressure shot up. 2 hours later, Dr. Heriberto Vera declared her dead and shared the news with Duarte's family. But her daughter, Sandra, later told local media he assumed she was dead and they disconnected her and passed her off to the funeral home. Funeral directors told investigators that they were shocked. Shocked, they said, to find her breathing and moving around inside the body bag at the funeral home. Duarte was immediately transferred to another hospital for observation. Wow. If only the first hospital had observed that she was still alive. Apparently she came back to life around Easter, and it didn't take 3 days. How long before she goes on a Paraguayan cross-country resurrection tour? Yeah. And within weeks of her release from the Sedgwick County Jail, authorities caught a Wichita woman inside the downtown historic county courthouse eating stolen Girl Scout cookies and blaring Cardi B. Authorities discovered 47-year-old Laura Christine Falau's nighttime caper when she pulled the fire alarm at around 3 a.m. and drew the attention of courthouse security staff. Officers rushed to the building after the alarm sounded and found Laura inside rummaging through offices on the second and third floors. She was also scarfing down the cookies and playing rapper Cardi B on a courthouse computer. Law enforcement promptly hauled her back to jail. She had just been freed from the Sedgwick County Jail at about 10 p.m. when she crossed the street and broke into the historic courthouse through a window. Laura had been in the jail for shoplifting cell phones, screen protectors, and headphones from a Verizon store. I don't know. Maybe this is a woman who is just hankering to be on trial. Looks like she might get her wish. And, boys and girls, it's now time for the moment you've all been waiting for. It's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff all presents the Idiot of the Day.
Deputies say a man in Wellington, Florida, told them he called in a fake bomb threat because he wanted to get out of work. Palm Beach County Sheriff's deputies arrested 36-year-old Richard Hamilton and charged him with making a false bomb threat. According to an arrest report, deputies investigating the call determined Hamilton was the caller and continued their investigation. They determined he was the caller because he used his own cell phone. Deputies say they found a vendor in the area who told them Hamilton was one of his employees. Hamilton told deputies he'd lost his phone. After searching the area and Hamilton's car, deputies say the suspect admitted to them that there was no bomb and that he'd made the call because he was having a bad day and wanted to get out of work. Well, he's certainly out of work now. I mean, why? Oh, why? Would you call in a bomb threat from your own personal cell phone and not think that you would get caught? One reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0561. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number. And once again, that's 0561. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on Apple or Google Podcasts, streaming on Spotify and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Let me leave you with these words of wisdom. Never, ever juggle ice picks while standing on your waterbed.